The Tom Woods Show, episode 494.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. If you're interested in more libertarian podcasts, let me recommend to you the Jason Stapleton program hosted by my friend Jason Stapleton. Monday through Friday, he gives you a libertarian look at the news. Check him out at jasonstapleton.com. Welcome, everybody. Today, we're going to be talking about history. I'm going to be talking about 3,000 years worth of history, maybe 3,500 years worth of history, courtesy of the Ron Paul Homeschooling Podcast with host Richard Emmons. I'm going to play for you a recent episode I did with him, and it's a very interesting and challenging episode because he would just throw topics at me from thousands of years of history and then ask me to elaborate on them. So I was really kept on my toes, and I hope you'll find my answers interesting. Remember to check out the free ebook I just produced on Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is Wrong. You can check it out at BernieIsWrong.com or by texting the name Bernie to 33444, and you get your free ebook. It covers all kinds of topics that he brings up, and I think you'll find it educational and fun to read. So do please check that out. All right, let's turn things over now to my conversation with Richard Emmons. Everything we're talking about, I mean, this course and how to get it and all that stuff is up at on today's show notes page, which is tomwoods.com/494. If you're interested in Richard's podcast, where he talks all about the Ron Paul homeschool curriculum, you can find that at ronpaulhomeschooling.com. And then if you want to join the Ron Paul curriculum, make sure you join it through ronpaulhomeschool.com, which is my own site, because that and that alone gives you $140 worth of free bonuses. All right, here we go with thousands of years of history.
Welcome back to the show, Tom.
Thank you very much, Richard.
Well, that's great. Well, this has been the first summer that you haven't been working on your courses for the Ron Paul curriculum. And I'm just curious what it's been like. You've been able to promote your courses. How's it going for you?
Well, it's much better in terms of my mental health. But yeah, I've been able to do some promotional stuff. I've actually prepared slides for a webinar about the curriculum that I'll be launching fairly soon. I've been able to do so many things. I put together a free ebook called Bernie Sanders is Wrong. That's going to be coming out in the fairly near future. I'm going to give that away. But I've been able to do an awful lot of things that I wasn't able to do before. I have so many projects that have been lurking in the back of my mind that I've been able to accomplish. So I'm quite pleased to be able to say they're not in the works anymore. They are finished.
Well, that's wonderful. And I just add my congratulations to that. And the flip side is that it shows how much energy you poured into these courses because you took everything you knew and you turned it into 180 lectures on Western civilization from ancient times all the way through 1492. And that's what we're going to be talking about today.
And I'll say, although I know we'll talk about this at another time, there's another 165 lectures taking it up to the present. So you put these together, and if this had been my only accomplishment in life, actually, I would feel like I had done something. So for this to have taken only a couple of years, plus I did that government course that we talked about in a previous episode, you know, at this point, I no longer feel like I have anything to prove to anybody. I no longer feel like I have to be working all the time and reproaching myself for relaxing. I'm going to relax for a little while, actually.
Good for you. Enjoy your family. The whole purpose of this podcast is to help tell families about the Ron Paul curriculum and about courses like yours in particular, because you just can't get this type of course really nowhere else in any high school do they teach 2 full years on Western civilization.
I've never heard of it myself. I took a year of Western civilization. I don't remember a thing about it, not one thing, other than there were serfs. I don't remember anything else, but none of it was presented in a way that was at all memorable. But even if I were the most boring lecturer in the history of the world, when you study something for 2 years, you are going to retain something from it. And not only is there just a lot of material, and by the way, when you look at the sheer scope of what's covered in a Western civilization course, and particularly in the courses that I'm doing, there's no way you really can do it justice in fewer than 2 years. When you consider, if you really, really do want to give some reasonable overview of all the thinkers, all the events, as well as some of the cultural contributions. I talk about the arts and other topics as well throughout the courses. I don't see how it can be done otherwise. But even if I were the most boring lecturer in the world, as I say, when you do something for 2 years, you're going to remember it. Secondly, I'm not the most boring lecturer in the world. Let me add that caveat. But thirdly, as with the other Ron Paul curriculum courses, we place tremendous emphasis on review, because especially when so much brand new material is being thrown at you, and let's face it, for high school students, Aristotle is brand new material. The pre-Socratic philosophers are going to be brand new material. When you get all this brand new material thrown at you, on the one hand, you may think, this is great. Look at all this great new material. I'm going to be a much smarter person. But on the other hand, if you don't already know something about Aristotle, or you don't already know something about the Crusades or any of the other topics we cover, then there's no way this new information is going to be able to take root in your mind. It's going to float in there, and it's going to float right back out again. The only way you can get it to stay in there is either talk about it constantly, which is impractical, or to review. So every single lesson, we have a review from the previous one, and then every fifth lesson is a review of the entire week. So that by the time you get done with that fifth lesson, you say, all right, already, I got it. Well, good. That's not meant to annoy you. It's meant to make sure it stays in your mind. Who wants to go to all the trouble of learning all this fantastic material and then not have it at his fingertips years down the road?
It's really great that you're emphasizing that, because so much of junior high, high school, you ask yourself as a student, why am I learning this? I'll never use this. And I'm not even remembering very much of what they're teaching me. But your approach is to help them to remember it so they can use it later in life. And one of the ways you do that is through the writing assignments. So why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Before I do that, I should say, when you mentioned, when am I going to use this later in life, I have a friend who is a classics PhD, who, when he is asked, why should we know anything about the classical civilizations of Greece and Rome, he answers, so as not to be an ignorant barbarian. So, I suppose that's what a classics major would say, but it is something that you're going to want to know for a variety of reasons. But in terms of the writing assignments, yeah, every week I'll give you one essay, or I'll give you a series of short essays and you write about all of them, or I give you the option to pick two out of three or whatever. And this also helps retention. Because when you write something down, or even when you type it, it helps to solidify that material in your mind. So you're going to read some texts from important thinkers, you're going to comment on them, or you're going to explain them to make sure that you understand them. I want you to explain them to me the way, let's say, a 10th or 11th grader would explain it. You use words that you would use and convey it to me. So these writing assignments supplement the reading that you have every single day. So you read 4 days a week. Then the fifth day, you write something about what you've been reading and what you've been learning. And this goes on week after week. And I like Gary North's remark that when the truant officer comes to your house, if we still have that function, you have this huge portfolio of weekly essays you can show. Well, this is what my student's doing. What are they doing in the local school? And the guy will sheepishly walk away and leave you alone. But it not only does it solidify the information, though, it also is going to help make you a better writer. There is no better way to improve in your writing than through sheer repetition. I think there are two ways that are tied. One is sheer repetition, and the other is reading people who can write well. Those are the two things. When you read people who can write well, it helps you to evaluate your own writing honestly. You look at your writing, you compare it to somebody who's really good, and you say, boy, this stinks. And that's not a bad thing. You should feel like your writing stinks, because frankly, it does. And when you're early on in your writing career, I look back at some of the things I wrote as a teenager, and I am mortified. I would not want anyone to see them. But it is a good, healthy thing to realize how much better really skilled writers are, because it makes you reevaluate your own. It helps you to be critical of yourself in a productive way. And that's how I went from being a terrible writer to being, you know, a New York Times bestselling author.
You mean you didn't just roll out of bed?
Well, the funny thing is, that sort of was my attitude in high school, because, you know, I was one of the smart kids and I was in all the advanced classes. So I felt like I was God's gift to teachers, and that everything I did was just was just laced with gold. And then in 11th grade, I ran into an obstacle. That was Mrs. Hannum in English. She didn't understand that I was Tom Woods. I'm the smart kid. I'm entitled to an A. She didn't seem to understand that. She said that my writing was too wordy. It wasn't concise enough. It was flowery. It was full of excess words. Whereas I thought that was good writing. You have a whole lot of fancy words, and you're as wordy as you can be. No, the key to good writing is being concise, is taking a machete to every unnecessary word. That is the absolute key. That is the thing that is holding most writers back. They think if I use big flowery words and I use a whole lot of them, that'll make me look smart. It'll make your writing read like molasses because every unnecessary word slows down that sentence. And she made me rewrite and rewrite and rewrite, and I resented this, and boy, I couldn't stand her. She did more than anybody else to fix up my writing because I had precisely that attitude that apparently I've just been given gifts by God, which maybe I was, but that doesn't mean that I have nothing to learn. I had a lot to learn, and it was when I finally had the attitude that I was ready to receive real instruction from somebody else that I could finally progress.
Well, that's great. I'm glad she taught you, and I'm glad you learned from it because I've certainly benefited from it.
I bet you thought that rolling out of bed as an 8-year-old, I bet you thought that was a throwaway question. But actually, that helped me verbalize this insight of mine, which was that when I finally lost the attitude that I'm this entitled little smart kid, that was when I was able to receive a real knowledge from people. And I always wondered if I would be any way to contact her and say, I know I was difficult in those days, but I want you to know you helped me a lot.
Well, why don't we just go through quickly through about 5,000 years of history to give people just the flavor of what you cover in this course. You start out with Hebrew history. So what are some of the nuggets that you pull out of that?
Now, this I could have taken so long on, obviously. As you say, I've got so much to cover. I start there. Normally what will happen in a Western Civ textbook is they'll start you with ancient Egypt. They'll start you with the ancient Near East. We'll talk about Mesopotamia and so on. But I always felt like they were really, really straining to show me the specific contributions that these peoples made. Now, that's not to say they didn't make contributions, but contributions that later thinkers drew from, it's a little trickier to prove. I mean, for instance, I can find people who lived in Egypt later on, like during the Hellenistic period, who had a direct and obvious and clear and very, very robust contribution to Western civilization. But when I look at ancient Mesopotamia, there's basically nothing about it in the political organization and the religion. Very, very little. You have to really strain to find exactly what the contributions are. So I thought, in a course like this, I don't really want to spend my time on that. I want to spend my time on the sources that are the most significant in the development of Western civilization. So obviously, from a religious standpoint, you have to begin with the Hebrews. You don't begin with them because of their achievements in a whole variety of other disciplines, but you do begin there because when we talk about God in the Western tradition, he has the qualities that we associate with the God we find among the Hebrews, so that he is one, he is sovereign, he is transcendent, and he is good. These are the four qualities that the Hebrews attributed to their God and that is then carried over into Christianity. And of course, Islam has an influence on Western civilization as well. And we see these characteristics. These are not characteristics that you find among other Near Eastern religions. So that's why we begin there.
Excellent. No, that's great. And obviously, from the Hebrews, we get the Ten Commandments, and thou shalt not steal is really the basis for private property, because if the civil government owns all the property, there is no private property, and we all own it all. There's nothing to steal.
Right. So the implication is you have to have a private property system. And of course, you can find other references in the biblical sources, Old and New Testaments, that will give you a robust defense of those things. But of course, you're right.
What about Homer and the Iliad? What did you talk about with that?
Well, here I'm introducing them to a work that is quite lengthy, and we're devoting only one lesson to it, primarily because what we have running in tandem with this course is an entire series of 2 years' worth of Western literature running at the same time. Now, in history, I have to talk a little bit about literature because it does fit into my story. But I don't go into it in tremendous detail because I know that's already being done. But here what I did is I took some excerpts from the text for them to read. It's not going to hurt them to read this twice if they're also reading it in the other course. But I wanted them to see the story when, you know, of course, we know that what's going on in this story is not – it's a story of the Trojan War. But we're also learning about these particular characters, about Achilles and Hector. And Achilles, not only does he kill Hector, but he really does degrading things to Hector's body, and he won't allow a proper burial. And there's this beautiful moment at the end in which he confronts Hector's father, and they have this very moving exchange when they both think of the losses that they've suffered in their own lives and in the war. And they begin to have compassion on one another. And it's such an extraordinary thing because the warrior ethic is being stressed throughout the entire work. But then at the very end, we have this, I mean, I think just an astonishing and a deeply moving moment in which one human being interacts with another human being and recognizes their common tragedy. And I wanted them to see this.
You spend a number of weeks studying classical Greece. So why is that important, and why do you spend so much time on it?
It's funny. Gary North and I have totally different views on this. Totally different views. He is not interested in classical Greece whatsoever. Whereas I am. I'm quite interested in it for a variety of reasons. I do believe that a lot of important ideas that are common to Western civilization emerge in classical Greece. Now, it is important, obviously, to remember that classical Greece was a slave-based civilization. The different city-states were based on slavery. In Sparta, in particular, they had conquered a whole lot of people and made them all into slaves. But we also have slavery in Athens as well. So we can't just say, well, liberty is born in classical Greece. That certainly is not the case. Secondly, in these classical societies, there is less emphasis on individual rights. The idea of freedom for them is not that you have the individual right to do whatever you want. In fact, even in Athens, they had the right to ostracize you. If a certain number of people wrote your name on pottery shards, you could be ostracized from Athens for 10 years as a danger to the state. Well, that's obviously not something we would approve of today. When they talk about freedom, they're talking about a corporate freedom. They're talking about the freedom of the whole city to make political decisions. That's freedom, is this group freedom. It's not so much the emphasis on the individual. So first of all, there's something to be gained by explaining that and showing people that the idea of freedom has developed and grown over the centuries. It's not like everybody was thinking in terms of the Declaration of Independence for thousands of years. They weren't. But also, when we look at classical Greece, we have great works of drama. We have great works of architecture that were obviously of great influence over the centuries. In looking at philosophy, we have the pre-Socratics, who came before Socrates, who are trying to understand the workings of the physical world around them and what ultimately things are made of. What is the primordial stuff of the universe? We have Socrates and Plato, who believed that there were absolute standards by which the world and your own behavior ought to be judged. But Socrates is saying that the sophists of his day were both wrong and dangerous when they seemed to suggest that really you are the standard of your own morality. That what's in the same way that you may be cold while I may be hot, that thing that you're doing may be right for you but wrong for me. Socrates thought that was certainly wrong. And the sophist's view was that since there is no absolute right or wrong, we ought to just train you to be able to make persuasive cases for whatever is going to advance you personally. And so Socrates thought you are raising people to be horrible, self-centered, concerned about not concerned about virtue or truth at all. So Socrates' view was that there was a truth, it could be discovered, there were moral standards, they could be discovered through rational argument. And this gets developed through Plato and his idea of the forms. And then we get to Aristotle, and I talk about his ethics, I talk about his political thought. You can draw out a lot of very, very valuable insights from them in both of these areas. So when we look at all of it taken together, we've got scientific advances, mathematical advances, philosophical advances, architectural advances, and one could go on. I think it would be it's a shame when people haven't been exposed to this. They will notice there are features of these societies that are quite different from our own. They will notice that women are treated not very well in ancient Greek society. People complain about women under Christianity. They obviously haven't studied women in Greek society. They were basically invisible in many ways. And we'll also note that if we think about the Christian idea of charity, that you should do what is good for somebody else without fanfare, without calling attention to yourself, without carving your name all over it, this would have been, and certainly that you would do good or even pray for your enemies, this would have been viewed as completely foreign and nonsensical to any Roman, certainly, and very likely to any Greek. This is an idea that would have made no sense to them. These sorts of things were thought to be reciprocal. You do something good for me, I do something good for you. Or if I do something good for you, you better believe that 3 months down the road when I need your vote down in the assembly, I'm going to expect it. This is different. So it's also interesting to note differences.
Absolutely. And out of the Greeks came Rome and the Roman Empire. Why don't you spend a minute or two talking about that? You know, America is often called an empire.
It's interesting to observe the process by which Rome goes from being this city into being, as you say, an empire. And it's an empire in two senses. It's an empire in a territorial sense that it rules over a very, very large area, which eventually is going to include North Africa. It's going to span from Spain all the way through much of Europe. It's going to have a presence in Asia Minor and so on. It's a very, very far-flung territory, but it also becomes an empire in a political sense. And an empire in a political sense means that it's ruled by an emperor. So it's ruled by an emperor over this great territory. It gets the emperor simply through a process that I spend three lessons on. And when I spend three lessons in a Western Civ survey course on something, that means it's important. Because I can't afford three lessons on anything, basically. Aristotle gets three lessons. Plato gets three lessons. And how they got their emperor gets three lessons. And the long and the short of it is, and by the way, this is fascinating stuff. I include in here some primary readings. People are going to read some of the ancient historians themselves because I want to show them that reading ancient historians is not impossible the way you may think. I think people think because they've seen Shakespearean plays and they couldn't understand them that everybody wrote like Shakespeare. You know, and Shakespeare obviously is a millennium and a half later. But the point is, you can read these ancient historians and you can understand them. You can understand what they're saying, and they are drawing a very, very dramatic picture for you. So I go through the century period, roughly from about 133 BC. Down to about 31 BC, in which we show the complications for Roman society that emerged from all this overseas expansion. You've got all these men who have been away fighting on behalf of Rome. And when they come back, they find that their farms are all ruined and unusable. Everything has decayed in their absence, and they don't know what to do. And in many cases, they sell off their land, and they go into the city to try to find some other employment opportunity. But they find in the cities, a lot of times they're competing against slaves, which is a difficult prospect. But now that they've sold their land, they're not eligible to be in the army anymore. So now you have this landless, restless group of people, and nobody knows quite what to do with them. So as time goes on, ambitious politicians who look to expand their own careers begin to latch onto these people and exploit them to advance themselves. We get ambitious generals who will say, you know what, I will take the landless into the army. Let's go. And these people now become loyal more to their generals than to Rome. And so when they come back, then the soldiers demand that the general hand them the loot that they expect. So this becomes a kind of a seething cauldron here in Roman society. You have all these people who look to their generals rather than to Rome to satisfy them. And they expect that war is going to be an opportunity for them to get loot and to enrich themselves. And as time goes on, you get rivals, you wind up with civil war, you wind up with Julius Caesar, and eventually you wind up with Octavian, who becomes known as Augustus, who restores order and brings peace through means that basically he's a military dictator, and that's what's going to happen for several centuries after that. But by that point, the Roman people are so exhausted from all the social problems and all the unrest that they're just willing to go along with anybody who will promise peace. And that's what happens.
Well, the next thing that followed that time period with Augustus is the coming of Jesus Christ and Christianity. So what do you cover in that section of history?
Oh, my goodness. This is a lot of fun because I personally find early church history to be quite interesting. That was actually the outside field for my MPhil degree, which is actually a history degree that I have from Columbia. Before the PhD, you have to take an oral exam for 2 hours in front of 4 professors. And you've been preparing for this for a year, and it comes down to these 2 hours, and they can ask you anything you want. So an American historian has to prepare the colonial period, the 19th century, and the 20th century, and also an outside field. So my outside field was early church history, and I had a professor with a doctorate from Oxford come in and examine me on that. So I have some background in this, let's say. I talk about the background of Christianity. So that is to say, what was the religion of Rome like, and what was going on with that? What was the world into which Christianity would be born? 2 lessons on the birth of Christianity, but I also focus on documents. So first, we talk about the New Testament, and I talk about the different writers of the New Testament. We talk about the 4 Gospels, and I explain the different audiences for each of these 4 Gospels, and I give textual evidence to help show that we can tell that this particular person is obviously speaking to a non-Jewish audience because he says that the Jordan was a river. Well, obviously, the Jewish people would have known the Jordan was a river. So in other words, I show how we can figure out what the intended audiences were. Then I talk about some of the other early Christian texts, like the apostolic fathers, people known as the apologists, like Justin Martyr, who were people who, in the 2nd and 3rd centuries, were trying to engage with people who had inherited Greek philosophy and trying to show that really Christianity is not a repudiation of Greek philosophy, it's the culmination of it. That if you're looking for these eternal forms of goodness and beauty and justice, well, they culminate in the Christian God, for instance. So they reside in the mind of God. If you're wondering where those are, that's where they are. Or the Didache, which is a very, very early text of showing what the disciplinary rules of Christianity were. We look at some of these texts. So again, I want to get people into the texts so they won't feel intimidated by texts. We talk about how did Christianity spread? What exactly were the steps? And how does it spread when technically, under Roman law, it is illegal? It's not constantly persecuted at all times and in all places, but strictly speaking, given that you're part of an illegal sect, you could get in trouble at any moment, and your neighbor could hold this over your head. So we talk about that, and then we talk about the Edict of Milan, whereby Christianity would be officially tolerated. But I also go into the early ecumenical councils, the Council of Nicaea, for example, in 325, which is clarifying the teaching on the divinity of Christ as against Arius, who had taught something quite different. And I show how an ecumenical council works. And there are a whole bunch of them in the history of Christianity that have been called to try to resolve either some practical question or some doctrinal dispute. And then the development of monasticism. And I talk about the role that the monks played as Roman civilization begins to give way to the barbarian peoples. A lot of things are not being done that used to be done. And so the monks are teaching people everything from irrigation to cultivation of bees and fruit and the making of beer and so on and on. All kinds of things that are practical, the monks are teaching. And later on, as we'll see, when other groups of barbarians come in, you can sack 10 monasteries, but every monastery has all the information necessary to recreate more monasteries. So it's like the internet. You can blow up half the thing and it regenerates. So this is an important part in civilization, that even in 9th and 10th centuries, when Western civilization is being attacked by the Vikings and the Magyars and the Muslims, the monks retain in germ a lot of the ingredients of the civilization. So you can sack a whole lot of areas, but the monks can recreate what was lost. And then finally, I talk about what was the relationship between Christianity and the culture of Greece and Rome. Does Christianity come? I bet most people would say Christianity would come along and say, since you people aren't Christians, we don't want to have anything to do with your civilization. We just want to repudiate it and start fresh. very, very few Christian thinkers thought that. I can think of only a handful. And interestingly enough, those handful, all of them fell into one heresy or another. The vast majority of Christians believed that there was much that was good in Greece and Rome. They wanted to keep what was good, expand on it, and use that as a way to reach those people and say, we're not just discarding everything you did. We're showing that Christ is the culmination of everything that all your greatest thinkers have been groping for. Now, you don't have to believe that to take this course, but you do have to know that that was the posture of the early church. Folks, we're going to pause for just a minute to hear from our sponsor. Hey, everybody, I know you like listening to podcasts and to libertarian ones in particular. Well, I'm very glad to recommend to you the Jason Stapleton program hosted by my friend Jason Stapleton. He runs Monday through Friday as well at jasonstapleton.com, and he has a 10-episode challenge. So that's 2 weeks. If you'll listen for 2 weeks, you'll walk away better informed, more knowledgeable, and better equipped to challenge both progressives and conservatives. No more being silent when the subjects of politics or economics come up. You'll know how to articulate what you believe with confidence. Jason's goal is to teach the value of individual liberty and economic freedom through current events. And so for a full hour, 5 days a week, Jason will cover the current political and economic news from a libertarian perspective. Jason was recently picked up by the USA Radio Network, making him one of the only nationally syndicated libertarian radio show hosts in America. So check out the Jason Stapleton program at jasonstapleton.com. And now back to the show.
Well, I think that's great. And I also think it's great that you point the students back to the original texts. You know, so many courses like this are taught from a textbook, and you're actually going to the original text that they can read and learn to judge for themselves.
And I think that is a selling point for the whole curriculum, because it's worth remembering that we don't really use textbooks. Now, in this course, I use a PDF textbook just to fill in the gaps, because I can't cover absolutely every single event, and if there's somebody they want to look up his dates or something, just to have a companion that'll take you through a skeletal version of the story, that can be useful to have, but you don't have to pay anything for it, and you can print out whatever pages you need or no pages at all. And the idea of this is this is deliberate. It's because textbooks cost you a lot of money, and any homeschoolers listening to this will know textbooks cost you an arm and a leg. They're boring. They're written by committees. They never have any ideas in them that are challenging. It's always just the conventional wisdom, like no historians have ever come along to challenge the conventional wisdom. So why get tethered to something like that when you can avoid it with the Ron Paul curriculum and read actual texts and some secondary sources from time to time?
Absolutely. It's a little bit like the first time you read the Declaration of Independence and you say, that's in there?
Yeah, that's right. That's where that comes from.
Exactly. Well, you're answering a lot of questions that you normally don't get even raised in a textbook on Western civilization.
Well, that is indeed a good part of it. I mean, for instance, I spend a whole lesson on the just war tradition, which I don't think is covered in a Western Civ course, and I don't understand that. I mean, that is, war is a pretty important thing, and the fact that you have people engaged in moral reflection on war is kind of an unusual thing, frankly, in world history. So I actually take people through from, let's say, I mean, you see a little bit of reflection on war in Cicero, in ancient Rome, but you really start to see it with Ambrose and Augustine in the 4th century. Then you see some in Thomas Aquinas, then the late scholastics, so we're getting now to the 1500s, 1600s, and then now getting more into the second course, Pufendorf and Grotius, and I tell the whole story of what were the principles that would establish a just war, how do these develop over time. So that's a question that I think is not raised a whole lot. Then secondly, I have a lesson on the church-state struggle and Western liberty. What historians have started to realize after Lord Acton had tried to tell them this over 100 years ago, they're finally catching up with Lord Acton, that the struggles that we see between church and state actually helped to build the tradition of Western liberty. Because first of all, it meant that there were two different power centers. They weren't absorbed as one. And you do see that. I mean, frankly, you see that in Islamic civilization. Everybody knows that. There's no way you can talk about church and state division. It's one thing. That's what we're seeing at this time in Islamic civilization. We're also seeing that in the Orthodox East, where you have Caesaropapism. You have a figure who can interfere in the life of the church as he wishes. But there is this attempt to delineate roles. and there are, and you've got popes excommunicating kings and so on. And so people think in terms of the possibility of resistance against political authority. All these things get raised and are part and parcel of this church-state struggle.
What came to mind when you're talking about Augustine is that followed all of the wars of Rome and all of that fighting. And then in the 1500s, that followed the Hundred Year War and all of those medieval wars. And do you think that's that tying to today, and I'm thinking specifically of Ron Paul's book, Swords into Plowshares, might indicate that Americans are going to start to reflect upon these endless wars that have been going on for about 100 years here in America?
One can hope so, and I don't think that's entirely just a naive hope, because I think people today, not everybody, obviously not enough, but I think people are much more reflective about foreign policy than they were, you know, even 20 or 30 years ago. I see especially younger people who, although some of them for some reason will accept government propaganda on things like milk subsidies, they don't accept it on foreign policy. They believe they're being lied to, and they believe that the consequences have been bad for everyone. They've been bad for the countries being attacked. They've been bad for the U.S. There's much more instability than there was before. They've been bad for a lot of the people fighting the wars. So I do think that there is an opening for that. And the fact that the people who seem to generate the most interest politically are the ones who at least are not just clones of the establishment when it comes to foreign policy.
Well, I just wanted to highlight that because, you know, again, it gets back to why study Western civilization. And what your students learn is that there are times in which war is just a normal thing, and there are other times in which it's challenged, and that's true today.
Yeah, absolutely.
You cover so much ground in this course. When people think about the Middle Ages or medieval, what's one thing that students will come away learning from your course about that time period?
Well, certainly they'll realize that the general public's view of the Middle Ages is just all wrong. In the same way that their view of economics is all wrong. I mean, it's just the myths they believe, what they believe about Franklin Roosevelt is all wrong. Why should it surprise us that what people believe about the Middle Ages is all wrong? You ask a medieval historian, a historian of the Middle Ages, was this just a time where nothing important happened and everybody was just an ignorant idiot? And he'll shake his head and say, oh my gosh, my life has been for nothing. Because for, I don't know, at least 100 years, certainly 50 to 60, but it's got to be more than that. Medieval historians have been trying to overturn the conventional wisdom about the Middle Ages. So I talk about that, and we talk about, for example, the development of the university system. If you're going to say this is all just dark ages, well, would you really call it a dark age in which the university system was developed? I mean, obviously something else is going on here. Or when we look at we look at scholastic philosophy, so we're looking really here, maybe the 1100s, 1200s, 1300s, and you look at the sophistication of these people, these are not idiots. I mean, these are people who would make absolute mincemeat in a debate of all the 11th graders out there who think they know everything there is to know about the world, and that these people in the Middle Ages must have been backward rubes. These people would be chewed up and spit out by the debaters and philosophers of the Middle Ages, particularly somebody like Thomas Aquinas. So I actually spend some time with Thomas Aquinas. We spend some time talking about who he was, the history of his life, and then we go through some of his actual work. So I take you through one of his five ways that he believed the existence of God could be demonstrated. Because it doesn't matter if you believe in God. It does not matter. If you don't want to be an ignorant barbarian, you do need to know something about what people who disagree with you believed and how they argued it. And you should know something about Thomas Aquinas and how he argued things. So I actually take you through one of his arguments. And you can accept it, you can reject it, but what you can't do is say, I'm going to block my ears and not listen because it's something I disagree with. That's not how a civilized person or a person who really thirsts for education is going to respond. So I spend some time doing that. And then, of course, when we look at, I do talk about Dante and the Divine Comedy a little bit, even though that'll also be covered in the literature course. I mean, that's a major, major contribution. Coming in the toward the end of the High Middle Ages, and we start to get into the Late Middle Ages. And then, of course, I spend a whole lesson on the cathedrals. I mean, I don't know what kind of Philistine you'd have to be to not appreciate the cathedrals, but Paul Johnson, the great historian, calls the cathedrals the greatest contribution or the greatest achievement in the whole arena of Western art. So I explain the different features of the different styles of cathedrals, and we have a lot of slides showing them to you. So what you would walk away with is that every period of Western history makes some contribution to who we are today, or makes some valuable contribution to civilization itself. The period of time when the popes decided to move to Avignon, which was a papal-owned territory within the physical boundaries of France. And the reason for this was that they had just had a major, major struggle with the King of France. And they really had come out second best in this struggle. In the late 11th century, the popes had had a bit of a struggle with the King Emperor of Germany. They had come out more or less ahead in that case. But here, we were seeing that the kings of Europe were growing stronger vis-a-vis the church, and it wasn't enough for the church to just issue some statement and the king would have to bend the knee. King Philip IV was getting away with quite a bit. As a matter of fact, he was making various demands on the church that were frankly grotesque from the modern point of view. He was extremely unhappy with Pope Boniface VIII, and he was even demanding of the church that he be allowed to dig up the dead body of Boniface VIII and put him on trial, which would obviously have been a tremendous indignity, and it would have been an indignity to the whole office of the whole papal office to begin with. So the church for a while began to think that the situation in France is just too hot for us to go back to Rome, where we are supposed to reside. That's the Rome had long been associated with the head of the church, but we're going to stay in Avignon. And as time went on, they began to get, well, kind of used to being in Avignon, and the papal office became weirdly French over time. The cardinals became French, the pope would be French. Meanwhile, Rome is a complete shambles, and eventually the papacy will return back to Rome in the late 1300s. By the way, after a couple of women saints badgered them and condemned them for not doing what they're supposed to do, they finally get back. But when they do get back, here's the big problem that occurs is there's a Roman mob demanding that when the new pope is chosen, he darn well better be an Italian. We don't want any more Frenchmen taking the papacy back into France. So they do elect an Italian, but this Italian, by some accounts, is mentally unstable. That's what some cardinals believe. He actually punches one of them in the face, and they go in and they hold another conclave for another pope. They say, well, we couldn't freely choose a pope at this time because the whole Roman mob was demanding that we choose an Italian, and we were afraid of them. So now we're going to choose a pope, a real pope this time, and he's going to be a Frenchman. And so the first pope refuses to resign. You wind up with two popes now, one of them in Avignon, one of them in Rome, and this really is going to cause tremendous problems for the unity of the church. You're going to have some countries loyal to one pope, some countries loyal to another. You have saints, people who were later declared saints, who were loyal to one pope, loyal to the other. It took basically two generations to fix this problem. It was fixed around 1415, and even at that time, so as not to cause further division, they didn't even decide definitively, well, by the way, the Roman pope was the true one. They didn't even declare that all the way until the 20th century, when they figure, okay, this has probably cooled down enough for us to officially say the Roman pope was the true one. But this caused tremendous issues for the church, and of course, the early pre-Protestant Reformation figures begin to appear in the 15th century. So they really, really shot themselves in the foot by doing this.
Well, why don't you just take that right into the Renaissance, and we can kind of end this part of the interview just highlighting the Renaissance. You spent a number of lectures on that.
I do. I've got two lessons on humanism in the Renaissance. We've got Machiavelli, who was a figure of the Renaissance. Four lessons on Renaissance art, by the way, because I think a lot of times people look at these paintings and they all look the same to them. Like, I don't know who's who and what's what. So this way you'll feel at least, I spent four lessons on that so that you can feel like, okay, I do know something about this, and it's not just all Greek to me. I talk about the Renaissance outside of Italy. I talk about the popes of the Renaissance and were they all terrible and so on and on. The political climate in the Renaissance. So there's a lot of stuff on the Renaissance. And basically, you have a couple things going on in the Renaissance. On the one hand, there is plenty of stuff showing that there is a robust Christian faith that is alive and well. When we look at the types of art being painted, and we do see a lot of among the laity, the ordinary churchgoer, there is a tremendous revival in personal piety going on. But at the same time, among some of the intellectual elites, we see some flirting with other ideas. That we see that some of these people are interested in studying, when they say, I want to study original sources, some of them want to study biblical sources. You know, let's go back to the Bible. We've been doing too many commentaries and not enough reading of the original sources. Or I want to read the church fathers. But a lot of them want to read ancient Greek and Roman texts. And not so much so that they can say, boy, how we've advanced since then, or how can we integrate Christianity into this? Instead, there is this sense that Greece and Rome deserve to be learned about and studied on their own merits, because they were great civilizations in their own right. And indeed, it looks as if some people were saying these were civilizations that got along just fine without Christianity. So there's definitely an undercurrent of that. Even in the arts, we begin to see that art is not exclusively, although it's still very much, but not exclusively religious. There's a lot more emphasis, for instance, on individual portrait painting, for example. And there is an increasing emphasis on individualism. And instead of saying that the model to emulate is the monk who is praying in his monastery, instead we should honor the man of action who goes out into the world and accomplishes things in a secular way. Or also, the Christian emphasis had always been that human beings need the grace of God in order to be any good, in order to accomplish anything that's any good. In order to be good in God's sight, you need to have the grace of God. Whereas there's more emphasis we start to see in the Renaissance on the natural man, without acting without the grace of God, just simply on his own strength, can accomplish great things. So there's definitely an undercurrent that's going to push you into the Enlightenment, where there'll be more of an open attack on Christianity. But we should bear in mind there is plenty of popular piety, and that a lot of these people are still deeply devoted to the church. But if you peel back a few layers, you see you see some change taking place.
Well, one of the things that came out of that was the Age of Discovery. So why don't you just talk about Christopher Columbus and just for a minute, and tell us a little bit about him that our listeners might not have heard before.
Columbus is just one person of a whole bunch I talk about in terms of the Age of Discovery. And it's fashionable, of course, to say that Columbus didn't discover anything because the peoples of the New World already knew that they existed. But as usual with snarky remarks, this is really unhelpful. The peoples of the New World, of course, had no idea that they lived on a globe. How would they know that? So in a way, of course, it's a discovery even for them. Secondly, it is not the case that Columbus, when he sailed, was being discouraged from sailing by people who feared that he was going to fall off the edge of the earth, that the earth was flat, and if Columbus falls off, you know, maybe there are dragons down there, they're going to eat him or something like that. It turns out that, to the contrary, every educated person in the 15th century knew that the earth was a sphere. Everybody knew this. There had actually been a figure, I think it was Eratosthenes in ancient Greece, or he was a Hellenistic guy, I think, who actually measured its circumference. So he knew it was a sphere, too. Everybody knew this. So why then were they, and I, by the way, I prove this, I even talk about how did that myth ever get started, that everybody thought the earth was flat. You still hear people repeating this today. Everybody thought the earth was flat. They didn't. This is a complete myth. Nobody thought the earth was flat. I find two people who were in the first millennium who thought the earth was flat. And even they, by and large, were speaking allegorically anyway. So a complete myth. The real reason they were discouraging Columbus was that he had underestimated the size of the earth. He thought that he can just get a series of ships and go sailing, and he'll be there in no time, there being Asia. And they're saying, no, you're going to be dead long before you get to Asia because there's so much open sea. Well, it turns out that they were both right. The critics were right that he underestimated the size of the earth. But he was right that he would arrive at land without starving, and the reason was there was, of course, as we know, there were the Americas that nobody knew about. It was that he had vastly underestimated the size of the earth. Now, I do talk about one of this. I mean, let's face it. The Europeans, in many cases, were not very very good in how they treated the natives. They weren't always terrible exploiters. The French, for example, in Canada, the French Jesuits were heroic in the way they interacted with the natives of the New World. But what is interesting about Western civilization is that unlike other peoples of the world who would conquer and enslave and never really reproach themselves morally about it, the Europeans actually felt bad about this. There were people in the Western European universities, particularly the University of Salamanca in Spain, who began to ask the question, should we treat the natives like this? Should we enslave them? Should they be despoiled of their property? Do they have the right to govern themselves and so on? And they came to the conclusion that, and following in the tradition, going back to ancient Greece, that there are absolute moral standards that bind everybody, that means we too, as Western Europeans, are bound by moral standards. And we should treat these people in the New World, who are just as human as we are, they have the rational faculty just as much as we do, we should treat them the same way we would treat other Europeans or that we would want ourselves to be treated. That doesn't sound like much to us today because that's such an of course to us. But the reason it's an of course to us is that we are heirs of these thinkers of Western civilization. They thought this all through, and they were able to reproach their own governments and their own people and say, it's not just a matter of we're always right because we're the French or we're the whatevers. We can be wrong because sometimes we don't live up to this moral standard that ought to apply to everybody. And that's an aspect of the Age of Discovery that I dare say is never mentioned.
Well, that's great. We've just gone over 5,000 years of history. I've learned stuff just in this interview. I know our listeners have. And why don't you close out this interview by just an overview of why this course is important? In particular, why should high schoolers study and understand Western civilization?
Well, first of all, it's going to give you a major leg up on your peers. Certainly, if you do any further education, you're going to have a massive knowledge bank that your peers will not have. This will serve you well in life. Secondly, the type of material being covered in this course is the exact kind of material that people later in life regret they didn't spend more time studying. You don't have to have those regrets. If you don't see the value of this material just by looking at all the lesson topics, then just trust me. I'm a trustworthy person, okay? I don't know how to prove that to you. You just have to take my word for it. I'm telling you, you're going to wish you knew this stuff later in life. Don't wish it. Learn it now. In other words, you get a chance to learn what some of the greatest thinkers who ever lived thought about some of the most important questions that have ever been asked. How could you say, that doesn't sound interesting. Why would I want to know what the greatest thinkers who ever lived thought about the most important questions that were ever asked? I mean, come on now, right? There's no way you're thinking that. I mean, you have to be curious about this. But to know about ancient Greece and Rome, I mean, exciting things happened during this time. Or Christianity. You know, people talk about Christianity, they don't know the first thing about it. They don't know the first thing about it. And I mean that by people who nominally claim to be Christians and people who are indifferent to Christianity, people who are opponents of Christianity. You scratch the surface, they don't know a thing about it. Not a thing. But you're going to read sources from the early centuries. You're going to be acquainted with them. You're going to learn how Christianity goes from a handful of people to basically to the religion of the Roman Empire. How does that happen? It is not obvious how something like that happens. How did it happen? Well, we talk exactly about how that happened. Then with the barbarians coming in and Western civilization taking a different form, we look at how do we hold on to these great things from the past? How does civilization keep on advancing? And then, of course, you're going to want to learn about Islam because that's a very important force in the world today. Well, I have a lesson on Islam. We have lessons, multiple lessons on the Crusades. Is it true that Muslims are upset at the West because they're still stinging from the Crusades? Well, I talked to you about that. And by the way, the answer is no, because from the Islamic point of view, the Crusades were so trivial that they weren't even on their radar. Like, it wasn't even until the 18th century that you even hear them talking about the Crusades anymore. It was not even on a blip on their screen. So when Bill Clinton said that 9/11 occurred, the attacks of 9/11 occurred because the Muslims were upset about the Crusades, he has no idea what he's talking about. The Crusades weren't even registering with the Muslims. But then everything from the Magna Carta, which is one of the foundational documents in the history of Western liberty, to the development of the university system where people can go and learn and exchange ideas, all the way down to the roots of why it is that Western civilization could get so rich. How are we so wealthy? And then all the way down to the Renaissance. I mean, you don't want to be somebody who walks through a museum and you don't know anything. Like, all these things are foreign to you. Or there's this famous painting in front of you. You know you're supposed to know what it is, but you don't. You don't have to feel that way. You can walk around feeling like I am in command of a huge amount of material, whether it's literature, philosophy, art, history. I know it. Well, look, you're going to feel good knowing that. And if that's what it takes to get you to dive right into it, then I'm perfectly happy.
Well, Tom, I think in this interview, you've demonstrated your depth and breadth of knowledge and your ability to engagingly present that information. I want to strongly encourage people to go to the show notes page, click through to the course overview page. You can watch Tom in a video. You can learn more about the course. You can watch lesson number one and really take advantage of this time in your life if you're a student to learn this information so you can have a better life and you'll be better equipped to debate. You'll be better equipped to vote. I think you'll be better equipped just to assess where we are as a country and where we might end up. And I just really want to thank you, Tom, for your time. And I just appreciate what you've poured into this course and what a goldmine it is for the people that are part of the Ron Paul curriculum.
Richard, thank you. All right, everybody. If you made it through this episode, super. You are one of the best. You can get this course through all the means listed at tomwoods.com/494. You can get it through tomwoodshomeschool.com a la carte. You can get it as part of the Ron Paul curriculum at ronpaulhomeschool.com. And you can get it as a supporter of the show if you're a gold or platinum supporter over at supportinglisteners.com. All those different sources are listed at tomwoods.com/494, and I've even got a free sample from the course. So check out the show notes page, and we will see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.